But that was better than the open road, where headlights could pick him out at any moment. He found himself a middling-sized tree that he could stand behind, close enough that he could still see pieces of the inman's lighted windows through the undergrowth. He was hoping for Linny May to come out eventually with his clothes. Gnats whined in his ears, and tree frogs piped. He shifted from foot to foot and swatted away something feathery, a moth. His heartbeat got back to normal. Linny didn't come. He supposed they had locked her up. After some time, he took his shirt off and tied the sleeves around his waist with the body of the shirt hanging down in front like an apron. Then he stepped out from behind the tree and made his way to the road. The ground alongside it was stony, so he walked on the asphalt, which was smooth and still faintly warm from a day's worth of sun. With every step, he listened for the sound of a car. If it was the Moffat's car, he would need to flag it down. He could already picture how the twins would snicker at the sight of him. One time he heard a faint hum up ahead, and he saw a kind of radiance on the horizon. He ducked back into the bushes just in case and kept a watch, but the road stayed empty and the radiance faded. Whoever it was must have cut off someplace. He returned to the pavement. If the Moffats did come, would he recognize their car in time? Would he mistake another car for theirs and get caught by strangers without his pants on? This was the kind of fix that the men he worked with told jokes about, but when he tried to imagine talking about it, ever, to anybody, he couldn't. To begin with, the girl was 13. Right there, that put a different light on things. Sawyer Road took so long to show up, he started worrying he had passed it. He could have sworn it was closer. He crossed to the other side of the pavement so he'd be sure not to miss it, although the other side was low-growth fields and he would be easier to spot there. He heard a fluttering overhead and then the hoot of an owl, which for some reason struck him as comforting. Much, much later than he had expected, he came across the narrow, pale band of Sawyer Road, and he turned onto it. The gravel was vicious, but he had stopped bothering to mince as he walked. He trudged heavily, obstinately, taking a peculiar pleasure in the thought that the soles of his feet must be cut to ribbons. He hoped Linny had found a way out of the house by now and was standing in the yard calling, "Junior! Junior!" and wringing her hands. Good luck to her, because she was never going to lay eyes on him again as long as she lived. If only she hadn't noticed that he'd been caught without his overalls on, he might have been able to forgive her. But, "Daddy, he's half naked," she'd said. And now whatever little feeling he might have had for her was dead and gone forever. He didn't know what time it was when he finally hit 7 Mile Road. He walked in the very center, where the asphalt was smoothest, but his feet were so shredded by then that even that was torture. When he reached home, the sky was lightning, or maybe he'd just turned into some kind of night-visioned animal. He nudged a sleeping dog aside with his foot, opened the screen door, and stepped into the close, musty dark and the sound of snoring. In the bedroom, he shucked off the shirt tied around his waist and felt his way to the chiffon robe and dug out a pair of BVDs. Stepping into them was the sweetest feeling in the world. He sank onto the rumpled sheets next to Jimmy and closed his eyes. But not to sleep. Oh, no. His whole walk home, he had been longing for sleep. But now he was thoroughly, electrically awake, watching vivid pictures flash past. The party guests gawking on the stoop. His skinny white legs with no pants on. Linny's witless face and her dropped jaw. He's half naked. He hated her. During his first months in Baltimore, Those pictures could make him wince and snap his head violently to one side, trying to shake them out of his brain. Gradually, though, they grew fainter. He had other things to think about. Just making his way in the world, for instance. Figuring out how it all worked. Adjusting to the unsettling look of the horizon in these parts. The jumble of low, close buildings wherever he turned. The lack of those broad-shouldered purple mountains rising in the distance to give him a sense of protection. At some point, it occurred to him that it was highly unlikely Mr. Inman would have set the law on him. As the man had said himself, he didn't want to shame his family. All Junior would have needed to do was keep out of the way for a while, and maybe partake in a fistfight or two if he chanced to be in the wrong place. But this realization did not cause him to pack up and go home. For one thing, he found it surprisingly easy to put his family behind him. His mother was the one he had cared about, and she had died when he was 12. His father had turned mean after that, and Junior had never been close to his brothers or his sister, who were all considerably older. Had he, in fact, just been looking for any excuse to get away from them all? But what was even more important, by then he had discovered work, prideful work, the kind that makes you eager to get out of bed every morning. When he'd asked after Trouble's whereabouts in the lumberyard that day, it had been in the back of his mind that maybe he'd get a job with him. Trouble had always struck him as interesting. He took his wood so seriously. In fact, his nickname was no accident. The mere appearance of his truck in the lumberyard would bring good-natured groans from the men, because they knew he would want to study each and every board as if he were looking to marry it. It shouldn't have any knotholes, any chewed-off ends or unsightly grain. That was the word he used, unsightly. He built fine furniture, was why. He used to work at a factory in High Point, but he quit in disgust and set up in Perryville, where his wife's people were from. And he'd more than once told the men in the lumberyard that he'd a good mind to strike out from Perryville, too, and go up north where there was more of a market for his kind of product. So when Junior walked over to his brother-in-law's house the morning he left home, wearing his lace-up church shoes that made his battered feet hurt even worse, he asked if they could stop by the lumberyard on their way out of town. All he got at the lumberyard was a mention of Baltimore, but that would have to suffice. He climbed back into the truck, and they drove to the gas station on Highway 80. "Tell the family I'll send them a postcard once I know where I'm at," he said when he got out. Raymond lifted one hand from the steering wheel and then pulled back onto the road, and Junior went into the station to look for somebody heading north. He had a paper sack with two sets of clothes inside, and a razor, and a comb, and $28 in his pocket. But he should have realized Trouble wouldn't want to hire him. Trouble liked to work alone, and probably lacked the money for a helper anyhow. After Junior had spent 2 days tracking his shop down, the man didn't offer him so much as a drink of water, although he was civil enough. "Work? You mean lumberyard work?" he asked, all the while keeping his eyes on the drawer front he was beveling. Junior said, "I had in mind something that takes some skill. I'm good at making things. I'd like to make something that I could be proud of afterwards." Trouble did pause in his beveling then. He looked up at Junior and said, "Well, there's a house builder in these parts who seems to me real particular. Clyde Ward, his name is. I sometimes make cabinets for him. I might could tell you where you would find him." He also suggested Mrs. Davies's boarding house as a dwelling place, which Junior was glad to hear about because he'd been staying at a sailor's hotel down near the harbor where they expected him to sing hymns every evening. After that, he never saw Trouble again. But he rented a room at Mrs. Davies's, In her three-story house in Hampton that must once have belonged to a mill owner, or at least a manager, and he went to work for Clyde Ward, the most exacting builder he had ever come across. It was from Mr. Ward that he learned the great pleasure of doing things right. He did send his family a postcard eventually, but they never wrote him back, and he didn't send another. That was okay. He didn't even think about them. He didn't think about Linny May either. She was a tiny, dim person buried in the back of his mind alongside that other person, his past self, that completely unrelated self who went out carousing every weekend and spent his money on cigarettes and fast girls and bootleg whiskey. The new junior had a plan. He was going to be his own boss someday. His life was a straight, shining road now, with a clear destination. And he supposed he ought to thank Linny for setting his feet upon it. Chapter 12. Linny's first act in Baltimore was to get them both evicted. During the night, Junior had awakened twice. The first time with his heart racing, because he sensed the presence of somebody else in the room. But then he found himself in the armchair and thought, oh, it's only Linny, which came as a relief under the circumstances. And the second time, when he was jolted upright from what he believed was a dreamless sleep, by the sudden realization that when Linny had said she was of legal age now, she had probably meant legal marrying age.
She's like one of those monkeys, he thought, twining her arms tight around the organ grinder's neck.
That time he hadn't been able to go back to sleep for hours. Even so, he rose early, both out of natural inclination and because there was always a rush for the bathroom in the mornings. He dressed and went to shave, and then he came back to the room and tapped the sharp peak of Linny's shoulder.
"Get up," he said.
She rolled over and looked at him. He had the impression that she had been awake for some time. Her eyes were wide and clear.
"You can't stay here while I'm at work," he told her. "You have to go out. There's a girl comes upstairs to clean in the mornings."
"Oh," she said. "Okay." And she sat up and drew back the covers and swung her feet to the floor. She was wearing a nightgown that would have worked better in the summer. A thin, white cotton petticoat thing that barely covered her knees. It was the first time he had seen her out of her winter wraps, and he realized she had changed more than he had first thought. She might still be too thin, but she had lost her coltish gawkiness. Her calves and her upper arms had more of a curve to them. When she stood up, he turned away from her so as not to see her dressing. And he went over to the bureau. A tin oatmeal canister sat on top. He opened it and took out the loaf of store bread that he kept shut away from the mice. Then he raised the window sash and reached for the milk.
"Breakfast," he told Linny.
"That's your breakfast? Doesn't your landlady give you breakfast?"
"Not me. Some of the others, they can afford to get their three squares here, but I can't."
He shut the window and uncapped the milk bottle and took a swig. It was something of a pleasure to show off how handily he dealt with adversity. Then he held the bottle toward Linny, still carefully not looking at her, and he felt her lift it out of his grasp.
"But what about in hot weather?" she asked. "How'll we keep the milk from souring when it's hot?"
"We?"
He felt that organ grinder panic again. But he answered levelly.
"In hot weather, I switch to buttermilk," he said. "Can't much go wrong with that."
The milk bottle jogged his elbow, and he took it and passed her a slice of bread in exchange, keeping his face set stubbornly toward the window where the smoke stood up from the chimneys outside as if it were too cold to drift. Tonight he should bring the milk in. He didn't want it freezing solid. Linny May was unclasping her suitcase now, by the sound of it. Junior folded his own slice of bread into quarters to get it over with quicker, and he took a large bite and chewed doggedly, listening to the rustles behind him. Then he heard the click of the door lock, and he wheeled around. She was grasping the doorknob to turn it. He lunged past her and threw himself in front of her. It startled her, he could tell. She drew back as if she thought he might hit her, which he wouldn't have, but still, it was just as well she knew he meant business. "Where do you think you're going?" he asked her.
"I need to use the bathroom."
"You can't. Someone'll see you."
"But I need to pee, Junior. Bad."
"The cafe down the street has a bathroom," he said. "Get your coat on. We're leaving. I'll show you where the cafe is." She was wearing what looked like a summer dress, belted and short-sleeved. Didn't they have winter back home anymore, or what? And on her feet were those same high-heeled shoes.
"Put on warmer shoes, too," he said.
"I didn't bring any warmer shoes."
How on earth did her mind work? "Come on the way you are, then," he said. "It's too risky to use the bathroom here. It's 6 men deep in the mornings." She took her coat from the closet and put it on so painstakingly that it seemed she was bound and determined to irk him, and then she lifted her purse down from the closet shelf. Meanwhile, Junior set the milk back outside, and then he hunched himself into his jacket and went over to the bed. The suitcase lay there, wide open, brazen as you please, and he closed it and bent to slide it underneath the bed, way back toward the wall. After one last look around the room, he said, "Okay, let's go." He peeked out the door first, making sure the hall was empty. He motioned her out ahead of him and locked the door behind them, and they walked the length of the hall and down the 2 flights of stairs without encountering anyone. They crossed the foyer, which was the most dangerous part, but the parlor door stayed shut. Junior heard the clink of china, and he smelled coffee. He wasn't one for coffee himself, but the smell always made him long for some, or just for people eating breakfast together, a slant of morning sunlight across the tablecloth. Out on the sidewalk, the cold air at first seemed a blessing. The third floor always collected the heat. Junior came to a stop and pointed toward the intersection with Dutch Street, where the sign for the cafe was plainly visible.
"But what if it's not open yet?"
Linny asked him. She was no longer bothering to keep her voice down, although they were standing right under Mrs. Davies's parlor window.
"It'll be open. This is a working man's neighborhood."
"And after that, what? Where will I go?"
"That's your business," he said.
"Can't I come with you to where you work? I could help out, maybe. I know how to hammer and saw some."
"That is a bad idea," he said.
"Or just wait in your car, then. I can't stay out in the cold all day."
She was standing too close to him, lifting her face to him. He could actually feel her warm, foggy breath and smell the sleepy smell of it. Her hair had a frowsy, uncombed look, and her nose was pink.
"You should have thought of that before you came," he said. "Go sit in the train station or something. Ride the streetcar up and down. I'll meet you out front of the cafe a little after 5.
5?
Then we'll talk about your plans."
He could tell from the way her forehead cleared that she thought he meant their plans. He didn't bother setting her straight. The work he was doing that week was for an elderly couple in Homeland, flooring an unfinished attic and changing a louvered attic vent into a window. He had found it the way he found most work these days, driving out to one of the better-off neighborhoods and knocking on people's doors. In his glove box, he kept the letter of reference Mr. Ward had written for him when Ward Builders had to shut down. But people generally took Junior's word for it that he knew what he was doing. He made a point of wearing clean clothes and shaving daily and speaking respectfully and trying his best to watch his grammar. Then, once he had a job lined up, He would drive off for whatever materials he needed. He had a credit arrangement with a builder supply in Locust Point. He would return with the Essex loaded down like an ant beneath an oversized breadcrumb. Best decision he'd ever made was buying that Essex. Lots of workmen had to transport their materials on the streetcar, pay the extra fare for their lengths of pipe or lumber, and enlist the conductor's help in roping them to the outside of the car, but not Junior. This particular job wasn't very interesting, but it was a good deal more useful than the hand-carved mantles and built-in knick-knack shelves of his days with Mr. Ward. The couple's grown daughter was moving back home with her four children and her husband, who had lost his job, and the attic was where the children would sleep. Besides, Junior knew that sooner or later things were bound to get better. Folks in these parts would be wanting their mantles and their knick-knack shelves once again, and then his would be the name that came to mind. People in Homeland could often be clannish, but this couple acted friendlier, and some days the wife called up from the bottom of the attic staircase to say that she was leaving a little something for his lunch. Today she left an egg sandwich cut on the diagonal, and he ate one half, but he wrapped the other half in his handkerchief to take back to Linny. Even though he was desperate to get shed of her, it wasn't all bad knowing that somebody somewhere was waiting for him. Junior hadn't had much luck with girls in Baltimore, to tell the truth. Girls up north were just harder. Harder to figure out and harder natured, both. So he knocked off from work a tiny bit early, more like 4:30 than 5. He found a parking spot just half a block past Mrs. Davies's, one advantage of getting home at this hour. As he was maneuvering into it, he chanced to look back toward the boarding house, and what should he see but that floppy old-fashioned felt hat and Linny May beneath it, wrapped in a huge denim jacket, sitting on Mrs. Davies's front steps as bold as brass. He didn't know which was more upsetting, that she'd show herself in public like that, or that she'd managed to get hold of her hat, which she had not been wearing that morning, and the jacket that hung in the back of his closet waiting for warmer weather. How had she done that? Had she gone back to the room? Had she picked his lock, or what? He slammed the car door getting out, and she looked his way and her face lit up.
"It's you," she called.
"What in hell, Linny?"
She stood up, clutching the jacket tighter around her. She was wearing her coat underneath.
"Now, Junie, don't get mad," she said
as soon as he was closer.
"You were supposed to wait at the corner."
"I tried to wait at the corner, but there isn't any place to sit."
Junior took hold of her elbow, not gently, and steered her away from the steps to stand in front of the house next door.
"How come you're wearing my jacket?" he asked her.
"Well," she said, "it's like this. First, I went into the cafe to use the bathroom, but they said I couldn't on account of I hadn't bought anything. So I told them I'd be buying a hot chocolate after, and then I sat with that chocolate and sat with it. I'd take a little sip only every 30 minutes or so, but they were real inhospitable, Junior. After a time, they said they needed my stool. So I left, and I walked a long ways. And this one place, I found a slat bench, and I sat a while. And this old lady and me got to talking, and she told me there was a bread line 3 streets over. I should come with her because she was going. You had to get in line early or they would run out of food. It was not but 10 or 10:30, but she said we should go right then to hold our places. I said, 'Bread line?' I said, 'Charity?' But I went with her, because I figured, well, anyhow, it would be someplace warm to sit. So we stood in that line, it seems like forever. All these people stood with us, and some of them were children, Junior. And I lost all feeling in my feet. They were like 2 blocks of ice. And then, when time came for the place to open, you know what? They wouldn't let us inside. They just came out on the stoop and handed each of us a sandwich wrapped in wax paper two slices of bread with a hunk of cheese in between. I asked the old lady with me. I said, "Don't they let us sit down anywhere?"
"Sit down," she said. "We're lucky enough to have something to put in our stomachs. Beggars can't be choosers," she said.
And I thought, well, she's right. We're beggars. I thought, I have just stood in a bread line to beg my lunch from strangers, and I started crying. I left the old lady and walked I don't know where all, eating my sandwich and crying. And I didn't have a notion where I was anymore or where the cafe was that I was going to meet up with you in front of. And that sandwich was dry as sawdust, let me tell you, and I wanted a drink of water, and my feet felt like knives. And then I looked up, and what did I see? Mrs. Davies's boarding house. It looked like home, after all I'd been through. And I thought, well, he told me the girl came to clean in the mornings, and it's not morning anymore, so...
Junior groaned.
So I walked right in. And it was so warm and toasty in the foyer. I walked up the stairs with no one to see me, and I went to your room and tried to open the door, but it was locked.
You knew that, Junior said. You saw me lock it.
Did I? Well, I don't know. I must have been distracted. You hurried me out of there so fast. Well, I thought, okay, I'll just sit in the hall and wait. At least it's warm, I thought. And I sat right down on the floor in front of your bedroom door.
He groaned again.
And next thing I knew, it was, "Ock!" I think I must have fallen asleep. "Ock!" I heard, and there was this colored girl standing over me, eyes as big as moons. "Mrs. Davies, come quick! A burglar!" she screeches, when she could clearly see I was dressed nicely. And Mrs. Davies heard and came running, came clattering up the stairs out of breath, and, "Explain yourself," she says. I was thinking since she was a woman, maybe she'd have a kind heart. I threw myself on her mercy. "Mrs. Davies," I said, "I'll be straight with you. I'm up from down home to see Junior because the two of us are in love. And it's so cold outside you wouldn't believe. So blessed cold. And all I've had all day is a little hot chocolate and a bread-lined sandwich and one sip of milk from Junior's windowsill and a slice of his store-bought bread."
"Lord God, Lenny," Junior said in disgust.
"Well, what could I say? I figured since she was a woman, wouldn't you think? I thought she might say, 'Oh, you poor little thing, you must be chilled to the bone.' But she was ugly to me, Junior. I should have guessed it. From that dyed hair. She said, 'Out!' She said, 'You and him both, out!' Here I was, thinking Junior Whitshank was a decent, hard-working man," she says. "Why, I could have got way higher rent from someone who'd take his meals here, but I let him stay on out of Christian spirit, and this is the thanks I get? 'Out!' she says. 'I'm not running a brothel.' And she flips up this ring of keys hanging on her belt and unlocks your door and says, 'Pack all your things, yours and his both, and get out!'"
Junior gripped his forehead with one hand.
"Then she stood right there, like I was some sort of criminal, Junior, watching every move while I packed. Colored girl standing next to her with eyes still big as moons. What did they think I would steal? What would I want to steal? I couldn't find any suitcase for you, and so I asked real polite. I said, 'Mrs. Davies,' I said, 'do you think I might borrow a cardboard box if I promise to bring it back later?' But she said, 'Ha! As if I'd trust you!' Like a little old cardboard box was something precious. I had to pack your things in a tied-up pair of your overalls for lack of anything better."
"You packed all I owned?" Junior asked.
"All in this big, lumpy, tied-up hobo bundle. And then I had to..."
"You packed my Prince Albert tin?"
"I packed every little thing, I tell you."
"But did you pack my Prince Albert tin, Lenny?"
"Yes, I packed your Prince Albert tin. Why are you making such a fuss about it? I thought you smoked camels."
"I don't smoke anything nowadays," he said bitterly. "It costs too much."
"Then why..."
"Let me get this clear," he told her.
I don't have a place to live anymore. Is that what you're saying?
No.
And me neither. Can you believe it? Would you ever think that she could act so ugly? And then I had to carry all those things down the street. My suitcase and that great knobby bundle and your canister with the bread inside and... Oh, Junior, your milk bottle. I forgot your milk bottle. I'm so sorry.
That's what you're sorry about?
I'll buy us another. Milk was 10 cents at this store I went past. I've got 10 cents, easy.
You are telling me I'm sleeping on the street tonight, Junior said.
No, wait, I'm getting to that. There I was, toting all our worldly goods, walking down the street and crying. And I was looking for a room to let sign, but I didn't see nary a one. So finally I just knocked on some lady's door and said, "Please, my husband and I have lost our home and we've got no place to stay."
"Well, that would never work," Junior said. He didn't bother dealing just now with the husband part. "Half the country could say that."
"You're right," Lenny said cheerfully. "It didn't work a bit. Not with her, nor with the next lady either, nor the lady after that. Though all of them were real nice about it. 'Sorry, honey,' they said. And one lady offered me a square of gingerbread, but I was still full from the charity sandwich. By then I was way down Dutch Street. I'd turned left at the cafe, and of course I didn't bother asking there, not after how they'd treated me. But the next lady said that she would take us in."
"What?"
"And it's a nicer room, too. It's got a bigger bed so you won't have to sleep on a chair. No bureau, but there's a nightstand with drawers and a closet. The lady let me have it because her husband's been laid off work. And she's been thinking for a while now, she said, that maybe their little boy should move in with his sister so they could rent his room out for $5 a week.
$5? Junior said. Why so steep?
Is that steep?
At Mrs. Davies's I pay $4.
You do?
Is this with meals? Junior asked.
Well, no. Junior looked longingly toward Mrs. Davies's house. For one half second, he contemplated climbing her steps and ringing the doorbell. Maybe he could reason with her. She'd always seemed to like him. She had asked him to call her Bess, even. But that would have felt impertinent. She had to be in her 40s. And just this past Christmas Eve, she had invited him down to her parlor for a glass of something special, as she called it, that she had bought at the paint store. But that had been sort of uncomfortable. Because even though Junior missed having people to talk to, somehow with Mrs. Davies he hadn't been able to think of a single thing to say. Maybe he could make like he had come to return his key, and then he would happen to mention that he barely knew Linny May, which was true, in fact, that she was nothing to him, merely a girl from home in need of a place to stay, and he had taken pity on her. But right while he had his eyes on the house, a little gap in the parlor curtain closed with an angry snap, and he knew there was no use trying. He set off toward the Essex, and Linny walked beside him with a bounce to each step, almost as if she were skipping.
"You're going to like Cora Lee," she said. "She comes from West Virginia."
"Oh, she's Cora Lee already, is she?"
"She thinks we're just real cute and adventurous to be up here on our own so far away from our families."
"Linny May," he said, stopping short on the sidewalk, "how come you claimed I was your husband?"
"Well, what else could I tell people? How would anyone give us a room if they didn't think we were married? Besides, I feel married. It didn't even feel like I was telling a story."
"Lie is what they call it up here," he told her. "They don't pussyfoot around calling it a story."
"Well, I can't help that. Down home it's rude to say lie, as you very well know your own self." She gave him a little poke in the ribs, and they started walking again.
"Anyhow," she said, "neither one applies. Not lie, nor story neither. I honestly feel like you and I have been husband and wife forever. From a time before we were born, even."
Junior couldn't think where to begin to argue with that. They had reached his car now, and he walked around to the driver's side and got in and started the engine, leaving Linny Mae to open the passenger door herself. If it weren't that she was the only one who knew where all his earthly belongings were, he would gladly have left her behind. The new room was not nicer than the old one. It was even smaller, in a mill worker's squat, clapboard house about 5 blocks south of Mrs. Davies's. The bed was a single with a sunken-in mattress, admittedly wider than the cot at Mrs. Davies's, but not by much, and there was a water stain on the ceiling near the window. But Coralie seemed pleasant enough, a plump, brown-haired woman in her early 30s, and almost her first words as she was showing him the room were, "Now I want you to tell us if anything's not right, because we've never taken in rumors before and we don't know just how it's done." "Well," Junior said, "in the old place I was paying $4. We were paying $4. But from the way Coralie's face suddenly lurched and froze, he could tell she had set her heart on $5. A cannier man might have argued even so, but Junior didn't have it in him, and he changed the subject to the bathroom arrangements. Coralie looked happy again. Now that her husband wasn't working, she said, Junior was welcome to take first turn at the bathroom in the mornings. Linny, meanwhile, was bustling around, needlessly straightening the bedspread. Plainly, she found money talk embarrassing. Once Coralie had left them on their own, Linny came to stand in front of him and wrap her arms around him as if they were honeymooners or something. But he freed himself and went to check the closet. "Where's my Prince Albert tin?" he asked.
"It's in with your shaving things."
He reached down a wrinkled paper bag from the closet shelf. Sure enough, there was the tin, and his roll of bills was still folded inside it. He put it back.
"We need to buy something for supper," he said.
"Oh, I'm taking us out for supper."
"Out where?"
"Did you see that place on the corner? Sam and David's Eatery. Coralie says it's clean. Tonight's special is the meatloaf plate, 20 cents apiece."
40 cents total, that means," he said. "One of those tall cans of salmon from the grocery store is not but 23 cents, and it lasts me half a week."
Although it wouldn't last both of them half a week, he realized, and he felt something close to fear at the thought of having to feed 2 instead of 1.
"But I want us to celebrate," Linny said. "It's our first real night together. Last night didn't count. And I want me to be the one that pays."
He said, "How much money have you got, anyhow?"
$7.58, Linny said,
as if it were something to brag about. He sighed.
"You're better off saving it up," he told her.
"Just this once, Junie. Just on our first night."
"Could you please not call me Junie?" he said.
But he was already putting his jacket back on. Out on the street, Linny was jubilant, hanging on to his arm and chattering away as they walked. She said Coralie had offered them half a shelf in the icebox.
"The refrigerator," she corrected herself. "They have a Kelvinator. We could keep our milk there and some cheese. And then when I know her better, I'll ask to use her stove one time. I'll clean up after myself real good so she lets me use it again. And next thing you know, it will be like the kitchen's our own. I know just how to work it."
Junior could well believe it.
"Also, I'm getting a job," she said. "I'm finding me one tomorrow."
"Now how are you going to do that?" Junior asked. "It's not like 1,000 grown men aren't pounding these same streets hunting any work they can hustle up."
"Oh, I'll find something. Just wait."
He drew away and walked separate from her. He felt he was caught in strands of taffy. Pull her off the fingers of one hand, and then she was sticking to the other. But he had to play his cards right, because he needed that room she had got them. assuming he couldn't somehow persuade Mrs. Davies to take him back. Sam and David's was tiny, with its specials listed in whitewash on the steamy front window. The 20-cent meatloaf plate included bread and string beans. Junior let Linny tug him inside. There were four small tables and a counter with six stools. Linny chose a table, although Junior would have felt easier at the counter. The customers at the counter were lone men in work clothes, while those at the tables were couples.
"You don't have to have the meatloaf," Linny told him. "You can get something pricier."
"Meatloaf will be fine."
A woman in an apron came out and filled their water glasses, and Linny beamed up at her and said,
"Well, hey there. I am Linny May, and this here's Junior. We've just moved into the neighborhood."
"Is that so?" the woman said.
"Well, I am Bertha, Sam's wife. I bet you're staying at the Murphys, aren't you?"
"Now, how did you know that?"
"Coralie stopped by and told me. She was just real tickled she'd found such a nice young couple. I said, 'Honey, they're the ones should be tickled. There's no finer people around than Coralie and Joe Murphy.'"
"I could tell that," Linny said. "I could tell straight off. I took one look at that sweet, smiling face of hers, and I could tell. She's just like the people back home."
"We're all like the people back home," Bertha said. "We all are the people back home. That's what Hampton's made up of."
"Well, aren't we lucky then?"
Junior studied the price list on the wall behind the counter until they were finished talking. Over the meatloaf, which turned out to taste better than anything he'd eaten in a good long while, Linny told him she had a plan to lower their room rent.
"You will keep your eyes open for some little thing that needs fixing," she said. "Some loose board or saggy hinge or something. You'll ask Coralie if it would be all right if you saw to it. Don't mention money or nothing."
"Anything," he said. She clamped her mouth shut. "You've got to stop talking so country if you want to fit in here," he told her.
"Well, and then a few days later, you will fix something else. This time don't ask, just fix it. She'll hear the hammering and come running. I hope you don't mind," you tell her. "I just noticed it and I couldn't resist."
Of course she'll say she doesn't mind a bit. You can see from that leak in our ceiling that her husband's not going to do it.
Then you'll say, "You know," you'll say, "I've been thinking. Seems to me you want someone around to keep this house repaired. And it's occurred to me that we might could work something out."
"Linny, I think they need the cash," he told her.
"Cash?"
"They'd rather let the house fall apart and go on eating, is what I'm saying."
"Well, how could that be? They still need a roof over their heads. They still need a roof that doesn't leak."
"Tell me, are people not having hard times in Yancey County?" Junior asked.
"Well, sure they're having hard times. Half the stores are closed, and everyone's out of work."
"Then why don't you understand about the Murphys? They're probably one payment away from losing their house to the bank."
"Oh," Linny May said.
"Nothing's the same anymore," he said. "No one's in any position to cut us a deal, and no one can give you a job. You'll use up your $7, and that will be the end of it, and I can't afford to support you, even if I wanted to. Do you know what's in my Prince Albert tin? $43. That's my entire life savings. It used to be $120 before things changed. I've gone without for years, even in better times. Given up smoking, given up drinking, eaten worse than my daddy's dogs used to eat. And if my stomach felt too hollow, I'd walk to the grocery store and buy a pickle from out of the barrel for a penny. A sour dill pickle can really kill a man's appetite. I was Mrs. Davies' longest-lasting roomer, and it's not because I liked fighting five other men for the bathroom. It's because I had ambitions. I wanted to start my own business. I wanted to build fine houses for people who knew to appreciate them. Real slates on the roofs, real tiles on the floors, No more tar paper and linoleum. I'd have good men under me, say Dodd McDowell and Gary Sherman from Ward Builders, and I'd drive my own truck with my company's name on the sides. But for that, I'd need customers, and there aren't any nowadays. Now I see it's never going to happen.
Well, of course it will happen, Lenny said. Junior Whitshank, you think I don't know, but I do. You went all the way through Mountain City High and never made less than an A. And you've been carpentering with your daddy since you were just a little thing. And everyone at the lumberyard knew you could answer any question that anybody there asked you. Oh, you're bound to make it happen.
No, he said. That's not the way it works anymore. And then he said, you need to go home, Lenny. Her lips flew apart. She said,
home?
Have you even finished high school? You haven't, have you? She raised her chin, which was answer enough. And your people will be wondering where you are.
It's all the same to me if they're wondering, she said. Anyhow, they don't care.
You know that me and Mama have never gotten along. Still, he said.
And Daddy has not spoken to me in the last 4 years and 10 months.
Junior set his fork down. What? Not a word? He asked.
Not a single word. If he needs me to pass the salt, he tells Mama, get her to pass me the salt.
Well, that is just spiteful, Junior said.
Oh, Junior, what did you imagine? I'd get caught with a boy in the hay barn and next day they'd all forget? For a while, I thought you might come for me. I used to picture how it would happen. You'd pull up in your brother-in-law's truck as I was walking down Pea Creek Road and, get in, you'd tell me. I'm taking you away from here. Then I thought maybe you'd send me a letter with my ticket money inside. I'd have packed up and left in a minute if you'd done that. It wasn't only my daddy who didn't speak to me. Not much of anyone did. Even my two brothers acted different around me. And the girls who were nicey-nice at school were just trying to get close, it turned out, so that I'd tell them all the details. I thought, when I went on to high school, they wouldn't know about it, and I could make a fresh start. But of course they knew, because the kids from grade school who came along with me told them. There's Lenny Mae Inman, they'd say. Her and her boyfriend paraded stark naked through her brother's graduation party. Because that's what it had grown into by then.
You act like it was my fault, he told her. You're the one who started it.
I won't say I didn't. I was bad. But I was in love. I'm still in love. And I know that you are too, he said.
Lenny.
Please, Junior, she said. She was smiling. He didn't know why. But there were tears in her eyes. Give me a chance. Can't you please do that? Don't let's talk about it just now. Let's enjoy our supper. Isn't our supper good? Isn't the meatloaf delicious?
He looked down at his plate. Yes, he said. It is. But he didn't pick his fork up again. On the walk home, she began asking him about his day-to-day life, how he spent his evenings, what he did on weekends, whether he had any friends. Even though he'd drunk nothing but water with his meal, he started to get that elated feeling that alcohol used to give him. It must have come from spilling all the words that he had kept stored up for so long. Because the fact was that he didn't have any friends. Not since Ward Builders shut down and he'd lost touch with the other workmen. To be social, a person needed money, or men did, at any rate. They needed to buy liquor and hamburgers and gas. They couldn't just sit around idle, chit-chatting the way women did. He told Lenny he did nothing with his evenings. He'd often as not spend them washing his clothes in the bathtub. And when she laughed, he said, "No, I mean it." and weekends I sleep a lot.
He was past shame. He told her straight out, not trying to look popular or successful or worldly wise. They climbed the steps of the Murphys' house and let themselves in the front door, passing the closed-off parlor where they could hear a radio playing, some kind of dance band music, and the sound of two children good-naturedly squabbling about something.
You peeked, I saw!
No, I didn't. Even though it wasn't Junior's parlor, and he had never met those children, he got a homey feeling. They climbed the stairs and went to their room, no lock on this door, and right away Junior started worrying about what next. On his own, he would have gone to bed, since he always got such an early start in the mornings, but that might give Linny the wrong idea. She might have the wrong idea even now. He sensed it from the demure way she took her coat off and the care she took hanging it up. She removed her hat and placed it on the closet shelf. Her hair was in disarray, and she patted it tentatively with just the tips of her fingers, keeping her back to him as if she were getting ready for him. Something about the pale, meek nape of her neck, exposed by the accidental parting of her hair at the rear of her head, made him feel sorry for her. He cleared his throat and said, "Linny May." She turned and said,
"What?"
And then she said, "Take your jacket off, why don't you? Make yourself comfortable."
"See, I'm trying to be honest," he said. "I'd like to get everything clear between us."
The beginnings of a crease developed between her eyebrows.
"I feel bad about what you've been through back home," he said. "I guess it wasn't much fun. But when you think about it, Linny, what have we really got to do with each other? We hardly know each other. We went out together less than a month. And I'm trying to make it on my own up here. It's hard enough for one. It's impossible for two. Back home, at least you've got family. They'd never let you starve, no matter how they feel about you. I think you ought to go home."
"You're just saying that because you're mad at me," she told him.
"What? No, I'm not."
"You're mad I didn't tell you how old I was. But why didn't you ask how old I was? Why didn't you ask if I was in school or whether I worked someplace or how I spent all the time that I wasn't with you? Why weren't you interested in me?"
"What? I was interested, honest."
"Oh, we both know what you were interested in."
"Hold on," he said. "Is that fair? Who was the first to start taking her clothes off, might I remind you? And who dragged me into that barn? Who made me put my hand on her? Were you interested in how I spent my time?"
"Yes, I was," she said. "And I asked you. Only you never bothered answering because you were too busy trying to get me on my back. I said, 'Tell me about your life, Junior. Come on, I want to know everything about you.' But did you tell me? No. You'd just start unbuttoning my buttons."
Junior felt he was losing an argument that he didn't even care about. He had wanted to make an entirely different point. He said,
"Shoot, Linny May," and jammed his fists hard in his jacket pockets,
except something in his left pocket stopped him, and he pulled it out and looked at it. Half a sandwich, wrapped in a handkerchief.
"What's that?"
she asked him.
"It's a sandwich."
"What kind of sandwich?"
"Egg?" "Egg."
"Where'd you get an egg sandwich?"
"Lady I worked for today," he said. "Half I ate, and half I brought home to give to you. But then you were all set on us going out for supper."
"Oh, Junior," she said. "That's so sweet."
"No, I was just..."
"That was so nice of you," she said.
And she took the sandwich out of his hand, handkerchief and all. Her face was pink. She suddenly looked pretty.
"I love it that you brought me a sandwich," she said.
She unwrapped it reverently and studied it a moment, and then looked up at him with her eyes brimming.
"It's squashed, though," he said.
"I don't care if it's squashed. I love it that you thought about me while you were away at work. Oh, Junior, I've been so lonely all these years. You don't know how lonely I've been. I've been so all alone all this time."
And she flung herself on him, still holding that sandwich, and started sobbing. After a moment, Junior lifted his arms and hugged her back. She didn't find a job, of course. That part of her plan didn't work out. But her kitchen-sharing plan did. She and Coralie got to be friends, and they cooked together in the kitchen while they talked about whatever women talk about. And before long, it just made more sense for Junior and Linny to eat their meals with Coralie and her family. Then, when the weather turned warm, the two women hatched a plot to buy fruits and vegetables from the farmers who rolled into Hampton on their wagons, and they'd spend all day canning, blasting the kitchen with heat. And later, Linny would be the brave one who went around hawking their products to the neighbors. They didn't make much money, but they made some. And Junior actually did fix up a few things around the house, just because otherwise they would never have gotten done. But he didn't charge anything or try to get a deal on the rent. Even after times improved and Junior and Linny moved into the house on Cotton Street, Linny and Coralie stayed friends. Well, Linny was friends with everybody, it seemed to Junior. Sometimes he wondered if those years of being an outcast had left her with an unnatural need to socialize. He'd come in after work and find wall-to-wall women in the kitchen and all their mingled young ones playing in the backyard. "Don't I get supper?" he would ask, and the women would scatter, rounding up their children on the way out. But he wouldn't say Linny was lazy. Oh, no. She and Cora still had their little canning business, and she answered the phone for Junior and saw to the billing and such as he began to have more customers. She was better with the customers than he was, in fact, always willing to take time for a little small talk and adept at smoothing over any problems or complaints. By then he had his truck, used, but it was a good one, and he had a few men working for him, and he owned a fine collection of tools that he'd bought from other men here and there who were down on their luck. These were really solid tools, the old-fashioned, beautifully made kind. A saw, for instance, with an oiled wooden handle that was carved with the most delicate and precise etching of a rosemary branch. It was true that the sweat that darkened the handle had not been his forebear's sweat, but still he felt some personal pride in it. He always took excellent care of his tools, and he always went to lumber yards where he could choose his own lumber, board by board.
"Now, fellows, I know anything you might take it into your heads to put over on me. Don't give me anything with dead knots. Don't give me anything warped or moldy." What if I had been married, he thought to ask Linny years later. "What if you'd come up north and found me with a wife and six children?"
"Oh, Junior," she said, "you would never do that."
"What makes you so sure?"
"Well, for one thing, how would you get six children inside of just 5 years?"
"No, but you know what I mean."
She just smiled. She acted older than he was, in some ways. And yet in other ways she seemed permanently 13, feisty and defiant, and stubbornly opinionated. He was taken aback to see how easily she had severed all connection with her family. It implied a level of bitterness that he had not suspected her capable of. She showed no desire to shed her backwoods style of speech. She still said "holler" for "shout," and "tuckered" for "tired," and "treckly" for "directly." She still insisted on calling him Junie. She had an irritating habit of ostentatiously chuckling to herself before she told him something funny, as if she were coaching him to chuckle. She pressed too close to him when she wanted to persuade him of something. She plucked at his sleeve with picky fingers while he was talking to other people. Oh, the terrible, crushing, breath-stealing burden of people who think they own you. And if Junior was the wild one, how come it was Linny?